seen Daniel. We've seen some great stories. And today we're going to tackle one of the other very, very popular stories. And we're going to talk about faith. Because really, I think this story that we're going to dive into today is really what faith is all about. If you've been brought up in the church, you'll recognize this story. If you have any inclination of spirituality from a Jewish perspective or an Islam perspective or a Christian perspective, you'll recognize this story because it's a story that many, many, many of us have heard and are familiar with. And so if you'd like to follow along this morning, I'm going to read from 1 Samuel. And the story that we're going to talk about today is David and Goliath. So let me just give you a little bit of context here because this is kind of important. So you got this king named Saul who was the first king. And he didn't do so well. So in the previous chapter to what we're reading here, it tells us that the Spirit of God has left Saul. So you need to remember that in context because as we read through this story, you might ask yourself the question, why did Saul do this? Or why wasn't Saul aware of that? Or what was Saul thinking? Or what was going on? Because at one point, the Spirit of God rested upon Saul and he did some amazing things. Some incredible things. And yet in the previous chapter, the Spirit of God has left Saul, King Saul, and that's where we pick up the story. So if you'd like to follow along, I'm going to read from 1 Samuel chapter 17, and we're going to kind of pause and start, pause and start, and pause and start. We're going to see some principles just kind of jump right out of the page at us this morning. But first, here's the context as we read from chapter 17, verse 1. Now the Philistines, Israel's enemies, gathered their forces for war and assembled at Socah in Judah. They pitched their camp at Ephrath Damim between Socah and Azgah. Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up their battle lines to meet the Philistines. The Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites another, with the valley between them. Kind of common sense warfare, even today. A champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. His height was 6 cubits and a span. That's about 9'9". Pretty big dude. He had a bronze helmet on his head and wore a coat of scale armor, bronze weighing 5,000 shekels. That's 125 pounds. That's almost the same weight as me, just to give you some context. On his legs, he wore bronze greaves and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod and his iron point weighed 600 shekels. That's 15 pounds. His bearer went ahead of him. This is a big dude whose armor weighs more than I do, generally speaking, and he's coming out and he is challenging Israel. Now, the old Saul most likely would have done something about this because the old Saul would have trusted in God, that God somehow would have delivered Israel from this enemy, but that's not what's going on. Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down before me. If he is able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." Then the Philistine said, "This day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other." On hearing Philistine's words, listen to this, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. Now that might not seem like a big statement, but if you read some of the previous chapters, if you read the history of Israel, God does some pretty incredible things. And one guy should not scare you or terrify you, but it does. Now David, verse 12, was a son of Ephraite named Jesse, who was from Bethlehem in Judah. Jesse had 8 sons, and in Saul's time he was very old. Jesse's 3 oldest sons had followed Saul to the war. The firstborn was Eliab, the second Abinadab, and the third Shammah. David was the youngest. The 3 oldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to tend to his father's sheep at Bethlehem. David's a shepherd. For 40 days, the Philistines come forward every morning and every evening and took a stand. Now Jesse said to his son David, "Take this ephah of roasted grain and these 10 loaves of bread for your brothers and hurry to the camp. Take along these 10 cheeses to the commander of their unit. See how your brothers are and bring back some assurance from them. In other words, Dad's worried. They are with Saul and all the men of Israel in the valley Elah, fighting against the Philistines. So early in the morning, David left the flock of the care of the shepherd, loaded up and sent out as Jesse had directed. He reached the camp of the army as the army was going out to its battle positions, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines were all drawing up their lines and facing each other. David left his things with the keeper of the supplies, ran to the battle lines and asked his brothers how they were. As he was talking with them, Goliath, the Philistine, the champion, the nine-foot guy, stepped out from his lines and shouted his usual defiance, and David heard it. Whenever the Israelites saw the man, they all fled from him in great fear. Now the Israelites had been saying, "Do you see how this man keeps coming and going? He comes out to defy Israel. The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He will also give his daughter in marriage and will exempt his family from taxes in Israel." It's a pretty good bargain. David asked the man standing near him, "What will be done for the man who kills the Philistines and removes this disgrace from Israel?" Notice his words, "this disgrace from Israel." Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of God? This is the beginning of faith. The beginning of faith is when you begin to recognize that something's not right. For us individually, it's when we begin to realize that something's not right in our own lives. And so when we recognize that, when we see the evil in the world around us, when we see the evil in our own hearts, we're called to speak up, to say something. And so that's what David's doing here. He's speaking up. He's saying, "Who is this guy? Why doesn't somebody do something about him? This guy's defiling the armies. These are my people. These are the people that represent God. What's going on here?" Verse 27, they repeated to him what had been saying and told him, "This is what will be done for the man who kills him." And Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men. He burned with anger at him and asked, "Why have you come down here? And whom did you leave these few sheep in the wilderness?" This is a few sheep. These are belittling comments. "I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle." His brother's pretty ticked. "Now what have I done?" said David. "Can I even speak?" This sounds like sibling rivalry, right? He then turned away to someone else and brought up the same matter, and the men answered him as before. What David said was overheard and reported to Saul, and Saul sent for him. So he catches the attention of King Saul. Saul replied, "You are not able." David said to Saul, verse 32, "Let no one lose heart on your account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him." Really? Saul replied, "You're not able to go and fight against this Philistine and fight him. You're only a young man. You're only a kid. And he has been a warrior from his youth." I love this, what David says. "But David said to Saul, your servant has been keeping his father's sheep." Oh, there's a good line to come out with. "When a lion or bear came and carried off the sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it, and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them because he has defiled the armies of the Lord. The Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will rescue me from the hand of the Philistine." David's going on his history here. Many of us have and will, or maybe even at this moment, face a giant in your life. Now, it won't be a physical nine-foot guy with a javelin going to throw it at you, most likely. But you will face giants in your life that as you look at them and as you hear what's going on, as you look at the situation and the circumstance, it looks like there's no solution. It looks like this mountain, this giant is going to overcome you. And one of the important things about faith is that faith doesn't just happen overnight in terms of how great you're going to face this giant all of a sudden all on your own. David recognizes that in his past as a shepherd tending sheep, that these things have gone on, and he attributes the credit to God and says, hey, God delivered me from this stuff. God was faithful back then, so God is going to be faithful now. And so one of the challenges of faith, and this is a command throughout the Old Testament, tell the stories to your children and your grandchildren. Tell them what God has done in your life so that you don't forget. So that when you face a giant in life, you'll remember when God did that in your life. And all of a sudden, as you begin to remember what God did, you'll have the faith to now look at the giant that's facing you and say, God can do it again. And so David's looking at his past going, God delivered me from the lion. God delivered me from the bear. He can deliver me from the Philistine, because this Philistine has no right to be out there every single day calling down the armies of God, calling down God's name. Saul said to David, go and the Lord be with you. Then Saul dressed David in his own tunic. He put a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened the sword over the tunic and tried to walk around because he was not used to them. So Saul says, well, if you're going to go to your death, let me at least give you some armor to protect you. Puts on the armor, and I would imagine it must have been quite a funny scene. Here's a shepherd boy all dressed in this fancy armor. He's dragging it around. He goes, I can't do this. I can't go in these, he said to Saul, because I'm not used to them. So he took them off. Then he took his staff in his hand, chose five smooth stones from the stream, put them in the pouch of his shepherd's bag, and with the sling in his hand, approached the Philistine. Another example of David's faith. This guy has not a shred of fear. I don't need armor. I face the lion and the bear without the armor. What do I need armor for? This thing's just going to tie me down. I'm not going to be able to fight the way that I'm used to fighting. Forget the armor. Just give me a few stones and a slingshot and watch what God does. Meanwhile, the Philistine with the shield bearer in front of him kept coming closer to David. He looked David over and saw that he was little more than a boy, glowing with health and handsome, and he despised him. He said to David, am I a dog that you come out and curse me, come at me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. Come here, he said, and I'll give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals. Verse 45, isn't it what David says? You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defiled. Notice how David doesn't say, hey, I've had some experience in this. I've killed a lion and a bear, so you're no problem, man. That lion was 400 pounds. That bear was 800 pounds. You got no chance. It's not about him. He turns it around and he makes it about God. The God, the Lord, will do this. Not me. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands and strike you down and cut off your head. This very day I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is God, a God in Israel. Pointing back to God again. All those who gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give us all of you into our hands. All the credit goes to God. All of it. It's pretty profound. Now listen to this. As the Philistine moved closer to attack him, David ran. Now it's a little word, but to me, I think it's a big word. Because even though I had the experience, even though God has delivered me from the lion and the bear, even though I've got these grand thoughts and desires and trust and faith in God that he's going to deliver me, he's going to provide, he's going to do this, all that may be true, but I'm still would probably be a little bit apprehensive and a little bit careful as I'm swinging that little rock, getting ready just to focus it on the aim and make sure I get it right, make sure it goes where I want it to go. But David just bolts and starts running towards the Philistine, swinging this thing around. To me, it's an incredible act of faith and an incredible action. Reaching into his bag and taking out a stone, he slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell face down on the ground. So David triumphed over the Philistine with sling and stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and killed him. David ran and stood over him. He took hold of the Philistine's sword and drew it from the sheath. After he killed him, he cut off his head with the sword. When the Philistines saw that their hero was dead, they turned and ran. Then the men of Israel and Judah surged forward with a shout and pursued the Philistines to the entrance of Gath and to the gates of Ekron. Their dead were strewn along the Shurim road to Gath and Ekron. When the Israelites returned from chasing the Philistines, they plundered their camp. Now, this is a pretty popular story. Most of you have probably heard it multiple times. But what an example of David's faith and trust in God. Now, the question might be for you and for me is, like, what does that mean for me today? I look at David's story and I go, I can't identify with that. And maybe we can't. Thousands of years later, we don't have physical armies gathering around us. But it's interesting that in the New Testament that the talks about spiritual warfare and spiritual battles that are going on. And the need for our faith, the need for us to have faith in a God who still delivers us today. And it can be from all kinds of things that are going on. And I would imagine that increasingly in our world, we are going to face more and more giants as we see society break apart, as we see things go wrong, as we see people run further and further away from God. And so when things get tough, when you find yourself facing a giant, and maybe it has something to do with your health, maybe it has something to do with your family, maybe it has something to do with your finances, maybe there's so many things that can go on in this world around us. But when you find yourself facing that type of giant, how do you demonstrate faith? How do you keep that faith? And I think we find that in those principles in the life of David. And the first principle is probably the most basic and the most obvious. But you just keep faithful. Because sometimes when this stuff happens, it diverts our attention, it diverts our worship, it diverts our faith in God and what He can do. We get so consumed with how big the giant is, how big his shield is, how big the spear is. He's got a sword bearer, the things that he's saying and everything that's going on, and I'm too small and he's too big. We get so consumed with the circumstance that we forget that God is faithful and we forget that he is calling us to be faithful. And so the challenge for us is, as we live out our faith, is, what is going on in your life when others aren't watching? So David didn't have an audience when he was killing the bear and the lion. But he was being faithful and looking after his father's sheep and doing what he was called to do and supposed to do. And so the question might be for you and for me then is, before we face this giant in our life, before we face the giants out in the world that are going to come, how is your day-to-day living? What does your life look like when others aren't watching? Daniel Meyer tells a story of an elderly woman who had heard a sermon in which she felt God was encouraging her to look for ways in which she could use her particular gifts and situation to minister to the needs of others. She thought about her gifts and realized she'd been told by others that she had the gift of hospitality. She lived alone in a small apartment near university and had afternoons free. So she pondered the needs around her and the people who tugged at her heartstrings. To her mind came the students nearby who were so far away from home. It was then that an idea struck in her mind that might sound a little bit interesting and strange and scary to some. She stacked a bunch of 3x5 cards and began to write an invitation on them. And on the invitation, she wrote, "Are you homesick? Come to my house at 4 p.m. for tea." She included a phone number and an address and then posted the cards all around the campus. After a slow start, homesick students began trickling into her house each week for tea. When she died 10 years later, 8 honorary pallbearers attended her funeral. Each one of them had been a student who once upon a time found a little hot cup of tea, a sense of home in the gospel of Jesus, in a hospitable home and heart of this faithful servant. What's going on when others aren't watching? What's going on before you face that massive giant in your life? Be faithful in the little, and God will trust you with the large. The other thing that I love about David, and I wonder, this is just a thought, but I wonder if one of the reasons why David is described as a man after God's own heart is because as you unpack David's story, and this is really the beginning of David's story, you'll see throughout his entire story that when he messes up, he points all the blame to himself. When he gets called out, he confesses his sin, and he has some pretty major mess ups. But when amazing things are going on and happening, when he's being delivered from giants and Saul and so many other things that you're going to see throughout the rest of David's story, David always points back to God and says, it's the Lord, it's him. He's the one that's looking after me. He's the one that's providing for me. He's the one that cares for me. He's the deliverer, just as we just saw in this story. He points people back to God through his testimonies. His story, the successes of his story, are credited to God's intervention in his life. And in our lives, not only are we called to be faithful as we live out our Christian life when people aren't watching, but when God does things in our life, guess what we're called to do? We're called to share and to point people back to God. Say, that was God. That's what he did in my life. He did an incredible thing in that point when I was faithful and I didn't know what was going on and I didn't know how God was going to provide. I didn't know how I was going to get through that situation, that circumstance. I didn't know how I was going to face that giant, but God was there. And he provided. Many of you know my wife's and I's story when we first came here just over 3 years ago. So it was 3.5 years ago in March of 2019 or whatever, 21 or whatever it was. And we had been living in Nezamim, serving for a couple of years. And I knew that my time was up. I went there to kind of help this organization, give it a reboot and a restart. They had a different vision, which was not what I believe God was calling me or even the organization. And so after giving it a couple of years, I thought, nope, we're done, we're finished, we're going to see what God's got for us next. And so we started to look for another ministry position. And so I've been in Ontario most of my life, but we had driven out here at one point and just kind of got hooked on the West Coast and thought, well, you know, whatever. So I was looking all across Canada, everywhere from Nova Scotia to Alberta, and lo and behold, after a bunch of interviews and a whole bunch of stuff, we ended up getting the call to come here. So when we finally knew that we were going to move to the Comox Valley, we put our house up for sale in Ontario, and it was in March, it was COVID, we were still living in Israel, so we had a friend who was a real estate agent, he put the house up for sale, it sold like in 3 days. Awesome. So then we started looking for a house. That wasn't so awesome. There was like 30 things for sale in the valley. None of them would fit our home. None of them were like, it was insane. It really was insane. We had a couple of quick opportunities that we put bids on. We got outbid, never knew what the places went for. It was absolutely insane. So we're living in Israel. We sold our house. We're looking for a new house. A couple of weeks later, there's another house up in Black Creek. We send in a letter, say, hey, this is who we are. We're looking for a place. We put a bid in. We got outbid, but the next day we got a letter from our real estate agent said, hey, the person that's selling the property, even though they have 4 bids above you, has said, if you will give us this much, then we'll let you have first crack at it. So that was miracle number one for us, because we watched for months after that and there was nothing else. And we didn't even fit in that house, but at least it was property and we could figure something out and live in RVs if we had to, or sheds or garages, which my son did. So I mean, we've made it work. So that was fine. So that was all in March. So then we were not coming to Canada. We were going to leave Israel in June because we were supposed to be here July 1st. And so in May, we start to get letters from our real estate agent going, there's something a little bit funny going on here. The people that have bought your house, which was an unconditional offer, They have a bunch of questions. And so here's a list of questions. And there were questions about our oil tank and did we ever have a flood and whatever else. And answer all the questions. There was, you know, we didn't have to, but we're just trying to be nice. And so we answer all the questions. We've never had a flood. We've never had any issues. The oil tank's a brand new oil tank, so whatever. So we answer all these people's questions and figure that's okay. And they said, well, it looks like in the basement you've had a flood. And I'm like, no, we haven't had a flood. We had a little bit of an overspill. We had a sun pump in the basement and it overflowed at one point, but we cleaned it up. So you might see a stain on a wall, but that would be the only thing. It's no big deal. And it's one of the disadvantages of having a sun pump in the basement. And so that was fine. We didn't hear anything, Then about 4 weeks before we're supposed to come from Israel into Canada, we had arranged to stay in our house in a couple of weeks while we did the quarantine thing. The people got weirder and weirder and weirder. And so at that point, we're starting to go, we might have a problem here. These people might back out. And the problem is they had put an unconditional offer on our house and we had put an unconditional offer on this house, thousands of miles away. And so we're like, uh-oh. And so 2 weeks before it's supposed to close, it was getting really bizarre. And at that point, the real estate agent going, I don't think these people are going to come through. And so they put a deposit, you know, you do your 25 grand deposit or whatever else it is. And so we were getting a little bit, say at least a little bit worried, because if that house doesn't sell and they renege, then the house up here that we had bought would renege, and it was an unconditional offer, so they would have sued us, we would have sued them, but in all the mess of everything going down, we would have been homeless. And so we really didn't know what to do. We were just praying and trusting that God knew what he was doing. And so we were supposed to leave a Monday morning. We were supposed to leave a Friday, and the house is supposed to close on the Monday morning. We thought, we don't need to just hang around the weekend. We've got to get out there and get our stuff settled. So we'll leave on the Friday and it'll close and the real estate agent will look after all the stuff on the Monday. Well, we thought about it, you know what, we better not leave until Monday morning, because 11 a.m. was the deadline when the deal was supposed to close. And so we waited till 11 a.m. on Monday and they reneged. So we now have a problem. Our house, the people walked out of the deal, so it's not technically sold anymore. And we bought a place up in Black Creek, which we don't have the money for, obviously, because we haven't sold that place. So what do you do? So we got in our van. We had all our vehicles packed and just said, well, God, you know what's best. And our real estate agent had a couple people lined up. We said, well, just try and line them up. So Monday night somewhere in Northern Ontario, we get a call from our real estate agent, and he has an offer for us. So it's the same as what the people had made. So that was talking about miracle number two. So all of a sudden, God miraculously provides his family. They're going to buy the house. They've given us the offer, the same amount of money. Awesome. Great. But they can't move in until August. So that means we have to bridge almost $1.5 million bridge finance for a month. And remember, we've been volunteering in Israel for 2 years. So guess what our income was each year for the previous 2 years? Nothing. So those of you that are bankers and know information about banking, when you go to the bank and the first question they ask you when you're applying for a loan or anything to do with money is, show us your last T4 slips or show us your income for the last 2 years. Well, our income for the last 2 years is not very much. We had a few people give us some gifts and whatever else it is. The volunteer, and they paid for all of our stuff over there, and our we rented out our place when we were away, our home back in Ontario, so it paid for itself. But on paper, we didn't have any money for 2 years, really. So we're driving across Canada wondering how the heck this is going to work, because where do you come up with $1.5 million or 1.34 or whatever it was that, in a week before the house over here closes? So I'm not kidding you. We're driving across Canada. We had a young girl who was driving with us, a 20-year-old, and so she served as my witness. We were serving papers back and forth, doing bank stuff and this stuff, that stuff, and everything through the whole week. It was absolutely nuts. And then Thursday, so 4 days later, the bank that we've been dealing with, there was a real estate agent that I've been dealing with for years and a broker who had been, all my buildings and things she had helped me finance. She actually got approved for us to get bridge financing for the bridge of the house for a month, even though we had no salary for 2 years. Miracle number four. The problem was that the house closed on Monday, and the lady said to me, she says, It never happens. You need at least a week, 5 business days to get all the paperwork done, the lawyer signed and everything so that this happens. So she says, I don't know what to tell you. You can try and connect with the other people and see if they have some mercy, if they can shift their closing date or whatever else it is. But she said, that's the best I've got. So Monday morning, as we were arriving, when did we arrive? Sunday night we drove here. But Monday morning by 11 a.m., the deal was supposed to close up here at 12. The bridge financing came through and all the paperwork for the lawyers and everything was signed off and done. That has nothing to do with me, nothing to do with our family, everything to do with God. Now that's a big giant. That's insane. When you've got a family with 7 kids driving across Canada trying to figure out how this is all going to work. But God is faithful. And so the amazing thing is that when God does things like that in your life, and they don't have to be that big, that's massive. That's a once-in-a-lifetime thing for me, I think. Maybe not. Maybe go do some cool things. I'm not going to doubt God and his faithfulness. But that was pretty big because it was, you know, I trust God. I have faith. I got a long story of God being faithful and so many other things in my life. And so I'm a risk taker, and I know God comes through in so many different ways, but that was a big one. And that had a little bit of stress to it coming across Canada. We knew that God would provide. And so when I tell that testimony, it's because of God, his grace, his provision. And the last thing that David does here that I think we're called to do is that he takes action and seizes the moment. We're not supposed to look for giants. I didn't look for that one. But when you see a giant, and when you've got the faith, and when you know God's going to do something great, and when you're trusting him, and when you're going to tell the story of what God has done, then just take the action and run headlong into the battle. Don't hesitate. Because God will be faithful. And I've still got stories and situations in my life right now that are giants, that I'm waiting for God to do something incredible. And all I can do is be faithful in the small and keep remaining faithful and remember the times where God has been incredible and where God has come through, to know that God will come through in these other situations and circumstances as well. Seize the moment, just as David did. How hard are you willing to run into that situation? Most of us would rather run the other way. And so when you're facing a giant in life, remember the times where God has come through. Keep faithful. And if you're not facing a giant yet, you just keep living from day to day and keep trusting in God and keep testifying of even the small things that he does in life. Because every single day, God is doing something for you and for me if we have the eyes to see. And many times throughout the week, many times throughout the day, you will have the moments to share God's faith, to take action, to stand up for God, to stand and to bear testimony, just as David did, if you are willing to. Let's pray. Father, you are so good and so faithful. And yet for many of us, it's really hard sometimes to be faithful when we're facing even small situations in life, let alone the big giants that often come. Help us remember, God, where you've been faithful. Help us share those testimonies to those around us of what you're doing. And may our faith increase as a people and as a church, so that others will know that you are Lord and King of Kings, and that you're in the business of saving. For these things we pray in your name, Jesus. Amen.